Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Fidela. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. Travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston, Kingston, Texas, County, Monterey, Faraday, Santa Fe, Dallas.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Well, thank you so much, Audrey. One more time, you did it. We're on the air, I think. It looks like everything is working. All these little bars on the new studio, they're all filled out in green and yellow and all that. So I guess all that technology display means we're broadcasting. Welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network, ladies and gentlemen. I've just been browsing out a little bit myself and seeing there are all kinds of interesting shows on there. Show on there on how to be a coach. How about that? You can be the best coach you can be by watching that show or listening to that show, among 14 other million things that these shows cover. I don't know if the Laughter Yoga, Audrey, do you know, is the Laughter Yoga show still on? Don't you feel better at all? We should. We're supposed to, according to that show. I'm not making fun of it. It's probably real stuff. Thanks, Johnny Cash, again, for taking us on that little trip across the country. By the way, you know, there is a Johnny Cash online radio station. Do people know that? You can Google it up and probably find it, but they only play Johnny Cash music, and then they talk about Johnny Cash history, and then they sell Johnny Cash memorabilia, that sort of thing. So if you like Johnny Cash, that'd be a place to stop by at least once or twice. Thank you very much. Emily's here tonight. Mike is here tonight. Lucy is gone tonight. So the Blonde Joe, guess who's going to do it tonight? I'm going to do it. And it's even better than that. It's a blonde joke that I wrote. Wait a minute. People are turning off their computers right now. Okay, we'll get through it. Purpose of this little thing here, this show, is to discuss news issues, events, and developments in criminal justice. We're going to stretch that a little bit tonight if you looked at the pre-show billing. And we're going to talk a little bit about John Stossel and his new book, No, They Can't. And there's a longer subtitle. We'll get to that a little bit later. But some things are going on in the news that relate very specifically to what John Stossel is talking about. And he's talking about government. We can do things better ourselves than you most of the time. And he's got some real good examples of that. And one of my news stories will be an example of the big daddy, any government doing some things for. You've probably seen a couple of these in the last several days. Our show is dedicated to criminal justice professionals, police, courts, corrections, juvenile justice, and all those others that we don't mention. The private security field, I don't spend much time on that, but we should, because more people work in private security than work in local policing in the United States, and they provide a wonderful service in so many different venues, athletic events and casinos and the streets and buses and all sorts of things. So anyway, we thank them also for doing their fine work. Blog Talk Radio is what you're listening to, as I mentioned, and Alan Levy is still the CEO. And this station, this network, allows you to have your own radio show, and you can do this show in no time. But literally, when you go to the page, it says sign up for your first show and start broadcasting. You could do that. Tell people I'm going to have a show in 10 minutes and go do it. So that's absolutely amazing. And you don't have to go back that far. This is 2012, I think, still, isn't it, Mike? Yeah, this is 2012. And to think that somebody could be broadcasting around the world at no charge whatsoever is just incredible. Somebody 10 years ago would have never believed that, even with the Internet. And these shows are archived. You can go to MP3. Download, is that right? No, podcast directory, excuse me, podcastdirectory.com, and you can revive all these shows and listen to them at your pleasure, should you ever want to do that. Tonight I told you we're going to talk a little bit about John Lott. I'll wait a little bit later. Not John Lott, that was, excuse me, I got guns on the brain here since I've been reading this book called Shooting Blanks by Alan Gottlieb. It's a fine book and a sub-author or a second author also. But anyway, what you can do if you want to, during the news segment, if you'd like, you can call in at 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983, and talk about some of these news stories. We don't really need to do that because we broadcast a lot in terms of our show content and the featured speaker. And tonight I think you're going to enjoy John Stossel. He's an interesting character. He's on Fox Business News all the time, which I never watch. I could write on my thumbnail what I know about business. But anyway, he's got some interesting ideas relative to all sorts of things that the government should and should not do. I guess you can Skype in now, too. That's what they said on the site. I don't know how we do that. I don't want somebody looking at me. But anyway, you can do that. All right. The blonde joke for tonight is simply this. What did the blonde say to the brunette? Oh, Mike acts like he knows. What did the blonde say to the brunette? She said, "Why don't you dye your hair?" It took a little while for people to catch on to that one before they applauded. They had to think. That was a thinking blonde joke. But why would they do that? And ladies and gentlemen, in this period of time, when even with crime down, as low as it is compared to the last 10 or 15 years, we do want to get out the message of the Ohio Coalition Against Firearms. And they, of course, want the criminals of the state of Ohio and the nation to hear their public service message and go turn in their guns to the police.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
Well, it certainly is a high coalition. We want to thank you very much for that message, and we're enamored with that message. That's why we play it. That's why we play it every week. And I will bet over the 7 or 8 years we've been doing this show. Is it 7 or 8? Yeah, I think so. But anyway, maybe not that many. But anyway, what happens is I'll bet many of these criminals have heard that thing and that announcement and going down and turned in their guns. How much do you want to bet? Don't bet much, unless you're betting against that idea. All right, a green tip for tonight. We always get our green tips. I think we have a few to go as I circle everyone each week. This one is from Esma Floyd's book, 1001 Little Ways to Save the Planet. And this is one, I must admit, I needed the education on this because I never think of this. And this is green tip number 994. And the headline is cut up your rings. No, that doesn't mean the one on your fingers. It says always cut up the plastic that holds your 4-pack or 6-pack of beer before you throw it away. as my must drink. The rings can cause severe damage to wild birds through strangulation and can also get caught on dolphins' noses, leading to suffocation. Now, there's one I never thought. Having thrown away some rings in my life, I never thought that a dolphin would get his or her nose caught in one of the rings. But there's a tip, and Esma Floyd has lots of them in that sweet little book. And what if we did all of those? Just think how we'd be sustaining the planet because of that. Well, let's take a look at some of these news stories, and some of them are some of these will actually make you gasp. At least it did me. And there's a point at which we just need to say, government, can you take a break? And there's no better place to start than New York City and Mayor Bloomberg on Wednesday, with his mental health director, Linda Gibbs. Here's what they said. They plan to enact a far-reaching plan on the sale of large sodas and other sugary drinks at restaurants, movie theaters, and streetcars. This is in the most ambitious effort yet by the Bloomberg administration to combat rising obesity. Do you remember a couple of years ago when Bloomberg made every place post the calories on their menu? Then they did a study, and guess what they found out? People ate more food since the calories were posted on the menu than before they were posted on the menu. Isn't that just about the opposite of what you would expect? But listen to this. I mean, come on. The proposed ban would affect virtually the entire menu of popular sugary drinks found in delis, fast food restaurants, and even sports arenas, from energy drinks to pre-sweetened iced teas. The sale of any cup or bottle of sweetened drink larger than 16 fluid ounces, about the size of a medium coffee and smaller than a common soda bottle, would be prohibited under the First in the Nation plan, which could take effect as soon as next March. The measure would not apply to diet drinks, fruit juices, dairy-based drinks like milkshakes, or alcohol beverages. It would not extend to beverages sold in grocery or convenience stores. And here's what Mr. Bloomberg says. Obesity is a nationwide problem. In all of the United States, could I add my little comment there? And who cares? Oh, in all of the United States, public health officials are wringing their hands, he's saying. He says, this is terrible. This is terrible. He said in an interview, New York is not about wringing our hands. It's about doing something. And I think it's what the public wants the mayor to do. So this mayor in New York City has little more to do, apparently, than to tell you how much you should be getting in your drink container. And if it's more than 16 ounces, it's going to be illegal. And, of course, it's going to have to be enforced. So maybe we're going to have, big drink police or something. Be careful how I say that. Go out and enforce this particular law. The health department's unhealthy obsession with attacking soft drinks is again coming up and pushing over the top. This is what Stefan Friedman said. It's time for serious health professionals to move on and seek solutions that are going to actually curb obesity. These zealous proposals just distract from the hard work that needs to be done. I think you could probably curb a little obesity by what? Moving more and eating less. Oh, it couldn't be that simple, could it? Well, maybe some say it is. This requires the approval of the Board of Health, this proposal, and they're going to debate this thing. And he sees this as one of his top priorities during his lengthy tenure. He also included bans on smoking in restaurants and parks, a prohibition against artificial trans fat in restaurant food. I don't even know what that is. I think I do. And a requirement for health inspection grades to be posted in restaurant windows. That's a hoot. I didn't know that. But he goes on and on and on. And someone in here calls him Nanny Bloomberg because of these kinds of restrictions. Some of these people are saying, I go to a movie. I can't get up and down 20 times during the movie, and I get thirsty, so I might need a 20-inch soda, or something like that. So, I don't get it. I really don't get it. This is going on. Registered U.S. sex offenders who've been banned from social network sites are fighting back in the courts. successfully challenging many of the restrictions. They see them as infringements on free speech and the right to participate in common online discussions. These battles pit public outrage over sex crimes against cherished guarantees of individual freedom and the far-reaching changes that have been brought by Facebook, LinkedIn, and dozens of other places. I get 14 million people a day want me to join LinkedIn. And I don't think I want to be LinkedIn, whatever that means. I know what it means. It's going to be really, really hard, I think, to write something that will achieve the state's purpose in protecting children online, but not be restrictive enough to be unconstitutional. So it's going to be interesting to see how that actually turns out. Do we want sex offenders? You know, there's a whole variety of sex offenders. They're not all the same. Some of these that get arrested and get a sex offense label stuck on them, and it is a sex offense, are these slashers, and the last thing they'd want to do is have somebody actually say, hey, come on. I mean, they're afraid of that, but, you know, and then they're the dangerous serial killer molesters also. But anyway, it's going to be interesting to see. Facebook, I don't know how Facebook deals with that now. I don't think they have any way of knowing. Who knows what Facebook knows? I don't know much about that particular thing. But the ACLU, which is challenging Indiana's 2008 law, argues that it's unconstitutional to bar sex offenders who are no longer in prison or are on probation using basic online services. No, they make a point. The other side is this necessary to deprive this woman's right in order to protect the community, because recidivism is high depending on the type of sex offender you're referring to. But anyway, that's something. Thinking of Facebook, the New York City police just nabbed 14 members of Crown Heights gang, dubbed the Brower Boys, and they did this by connecting with them on Facebook. These guys would get on Facebook and describe the kind of crimes that they've been committing. These guys raised in age from 15 to 19. They climb fire escapes and jump rooftops to gain access to victims' apartments. Well, that sounds fun. These Brower bums terrorized their neighborhood for 1 year. And then they got on Facebook and they started describing these things. So the cops played pretty heavily on that Facebook. So I guess, I don't know, is that legal? Could cops can get on anybody's Facebook? Because I know many of these police human resources commanders, you know, in charge of the hiring, they're telling prospective police applicants, don't get on Facebook, get off of it, because people say stuff about it on Facebook page number whatever or somebody else's Facebook about you that you don't even know, and it could be patently false. But when the cops come up with it, they come up with it. They have to check it out before you become a police officer. All right, this is a good one. This is another privacy kind of issue. Have you ever heard of ShotSpotter? That's a sensor. And this is a sensor shaped like a barrel on a streetlight. They have them in Richmond, California. I think Milwaukee's dealing with it too. And what this does is it hears gunshots. By the way, I'm going to talk about that the next story. There were some real gunshots to be heard in Chicago this past weekend. They had a great time in Chicago. Fun to read about, but not fun to be there. But anyway, what happens is that this thing can hear the gunshots instantly, of course, when they occur, and they come back with a signal and tell the police department where this is, and then the cops can respond quickly to that location. And they can pick up the shell casing, and one of these, they actually got a bleeding 15-year-old boy who'd been shot in the arm. That type of thing. The total elapsed time for that to happen was 3 minutes and 55 seconds. Now, I remember that some of the folks, I think at the University of Cincinnati, did analysis of ShotSpotters, and it wasn't called that then, but about 10 years ago or more in Dallas, and they weren't useful because there was too many gunshots in South Dallas or West Dallas, whatever it was. But anyway, guess what else these little things do? Oh, I bet you couldn't guess. The gunshot detection system also audio monitors they can listen to what's going on in the street. Now, I wonder how far away you have to be away from the monitor itself to be listened to. So anyway, people are saying this is good, it's bad, it's not good. He says a patrol officer would receive a gunshot call from the community, and you could spend up to 30 minutes driving within 3 to 4 blocks of that location just to make sure there isn't a victim in need of assistance. So this thing, at least in that regard, would be like that. And I bet there's probably a federal grant available to help or pay entirely for this particular type of system. But some of these chiefs and police commissioners are very satisfied with this kind of thing. I hope you weren't in Chicago this past Memorial Day weekend. This needs updated, by the way. There were 11 people died, and I think 43 were shot over the weekend. Somebody else said a news story in here that said it was like 48 people now. They found out were shot. But isn't that wonderful? Mayor Rahm Emanuel and Police Superintendent Gary McCarthy, they plan to outline a strategy to reduce violence in the nation's third largest city. They're thinking this is maybe too many gunshots and people shot for Memorial Day weekend. What do you think? It's only, 43, maybe 48, big city. But anyway, it's twice what it was last Memorial Day weekend. So that's an increase of 100% over last year. So what makes people want to shoot other people on Memorial Day weekend? I'm not sure, but I think they're not particularly impressed with Memorial Day weekend. It's probably any weekend would work. But anyway, can you believe that? I mean, I don't think I'd consider it safe to go in a lot of neighborhoods in Chicago if that's going on, would you? I mean, and you can't carry a gun there. I mean, although, the great case McDonald versus Chicago, Supreme Court ruled in favor of Mr. McDonald, who wanted to have a gun, and Chicago wouldn't allow any pistols in the city. That's changed, but Chicago's also still thrown up a whole bunch of impediments to keep people from getting guns. They have to work real hard to do it. And, of course, that's their objective, is just to discourage people from actually doing it. Can you believe this one? 7 officers and a supervisor at the Milwaukee Police Department have had their badges taken away after allegations surfaced that the police have been conducting body cavity searches on suspects with no authority to do so. Ooh, I never wanted to do a body cavity search. But anyway, reports of officers arresting suspects then subjecting them to body cavity searches first surfaced in local media in March. On Monday, after getting access to a police report, it says, the Journal Sentinel reported officers allegedly performed these searches on a routine basis. They have a reputation for it, for forcing suspects he believed had drugs in their body cavities to bend over and then do the search. Eeks. But anyway, these guys have been removed, and, there has to be a real... and one of the guys talks about how they found cocaine between these guys' cheeks. So, people do hide stuff there. I know they hide cell phones. Oh, my gosh, can you believe that? But anyway, they smuggle them into prison that way sometimes. But anyway, to detain somebody and look at their genitals, buttocks, anus, whatever, on a detained female person's breast can only be performed by a doctor, physician's assistant, or registered nurse. This state requires written permission before strip search is conducted, unless there's probable cause to believe the suspect is hiding a weapon. Now, prison's a different type of environment. They don't have the same type of rights, and sometimes full-body cavity searches are done there, not routinely, but frequently, I would say. So anyway, it's going to be interesting how that turns out in Milwaukee. One guy describes what happened to him. He says, when they searched me, they eased their hands right up between I tried to reach back. As soon as I tried to reach back to stop them, they slammed me on the ground. But anyway, isn't that incredible? It's illegal to conduct a body cavity search outside where other people can see. And apparently they had done that too. So interesting stuff. The governor of Virginia, guess what? He is thoroughly impressed with police flying drones You're going to see a lot of that coming up, and I'll bet some federal dollars are going for this. But you're going to have little tiny airplanes flying around your city, and they're going to be doing surveillance. Isn't that amazing? And when you look out that window and you see that hawk out there or carrier pigeon or whatever it is, don't necessarily think that's what it is, because it could be a police department's flying drone with a real good camera action. And they're thinking this is going to be good. It's going to help spot traffic backups. It's going to be doing all kinds of things in a smart traffic center. Police Chief Kathy Lanier, she's a national security expert. She told the news station that the use of drones is ideal for sprawling counties such as Fairfax. Isn't that great? So how many different ways can they look at us and watch us? But anyway, that's the news for tonight, most of it. What we're going to do now is take a listen to John Stossel. And his book is called No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. And you could hear the whole thing on booktv.org, booktv.org. We've used it many times. And Stossel contends that the government and politicians, regardless of their political affiliation, are incapable of addressing the political and social issues facing the U.S. He's an author and a host on Fox Business News. He argues that America needs to think as individuals and stop linking or looking to the government for assistance. He does this. He takes his perspective on a whole range of the subjects, from free trade, health insurance, education, all kinds of things. So I think you'll enjoy this. We'll cut off about 5 minutes before 10 o'clock Eastern Standard Time. And this is John Stossel talking about his book, No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed.
Topics list on the upper right side of the page. Up next on Book TV, John Stossel contends that the government and politicians, regardless of political affiliation, are incapable of addressing the political and social issues facing the U.S. The author, host of Fox Business Network's Stossel, argues that Americans need to think as individuals and stop looking to the government for assistance. This is just under an hour.
Thank you all for coming. I'm Larry Moten, the president, and we're delighted to provide a forum for our good friend John Stossel to talk about his new book, No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. And here to introduce John today is his colleague and intellectual collaborator, Judge Andrew Napolitano. As you all know, Judge Napolitano is a Fox News senior judicial analyst, providing daily analysis on the Fox News and Fox Business channels. The judge is the youngest life-tenured Superior Court judge in the history of the state of New Jersey, serving on the bench from 1987 to 95. He also served as an adjunct professor of constitutional law at Seton Law School for many years, and he has published 6 books on government and the law, and they're all terrific, by the way. His latest book, published last fall, is titled, It is Dangerous to be Right When the Government is Wrong. Great title. The Case for Personal Freedom. Please join me in welcoming a true champion of economic and individual liberty, Judge Andrew Napolitano. My friend Voltaire suggested that title. Nice to be here. The young lady with whom I'm seated said they're going to make you sing for your lunch, so you better do a good job in introducing this character, Stossel. This character, Stossel, and I first met, he probably doesn't remember this, in 1969 when I was a freshman and he was a senior, not at the institution after which this place is named, but at the one up the block, the colors of which are black and orange. We were students at Princeton together. Now, John had long hair, was running a newspaper, a left-wing rag called the Daily Princetonian, and was wearing a T-shirt that said, "Burn it down, baby." That's all right. I had a crew cut. I was wearing a T-shirt that said, "Bomb Hanoi." Since then, the two of us have answered that siren call of human freedom and have devoted our careers to the defense of it. I had the privilege of doing so on the bench in the Superior Court in New Jersey and in New Jersey's and New York City's courtrooms. John has done so on television like no other person has. John, as you know, is the recipient of 19 Emmys. Most of my colleagues would kill to have one. John has 19. Why does he have 19 Emmys? Because he is intellectually honest, utterly steadfast, and always on top of his game. I'm going to give you a little example. The other day, I was at Princeton University listening to a speech by George Will. He was comparing the presidencies of the two Princetonians who became president, Woodrow Wilson and James Madison. You can imagine which one he favored, thank goodness. Seated next to me is a woman that keeps poking me in the ribs every time Will says something that blasts Wilson or praises Madison. At the end of the speech, she says to me, "No, you should tell Stossel that he should come down here and do one of the shows at Princeton. There'd be 1,000 students screaming to hear him." And I said to her, "Really?" She said, "Yes, look, when you and Stossel were students here, maybe you were the only two libertarians. But that's not the case now." I'm thinking to myself, is this some nut job or is this some lady that I should know who she is talking about Stossel like this? I said, "By the way, madam, my name is Andrew Napolitano." She said, "Yes, I know who you are. I'm Shirley Tillman, the president of Princeton University." So there's your invitation, John. One day I was getting a little carried away on air. One day I was getting carried away on air. And I used a phrase that I really believe in. I know there are arguments on the other side, and I know not everybody in this room will agree with me, but I happen to utter the phrase, "Taxation is theft." Well, John calls me up and goes, "Judge, you're killing me." I said, "What do you mean I'm killing you?" He said, "When you say something like taxation is theft, my inbox is filled with emailers saying, why don't you say that kind of stuff?" John is a champion of human freedom, who has the gift of explaining it in a way that everybody can understand, and nobody can find him disagreeable. The other day I was looking at a piece of literature, something from Reason, advertising some speech that I'm going to be giving in November, and there was a picture in this Reason publication of John Stossel just about 2 or 3 months ago playing volleyball on a beach in California with a bunch of 19-year-olds. Now, if you blinked your eyes 3 times, you couldn't tell which of them was fill in the blank John's age and which of them was the 19-year-old. There are times when I look at him and I say, that's what I want to look like when I grow up. I know when I was on the bench, I used to say, that's what I want to be like when I grow up. And now I can say, he is the man I admire most. He is my friend, my colleague, and my mentor, John Stossel.
Wow, Andrew, thank you. That is very kind. And I should say I interviewed him for my first TV special when I was nervously branching out in your direction. And he was so quiet and careful and timid that we couldn't use it. He's changed since then. He is far more brilliant on the principles of liberty than I in terms of the law. I come at it as a consumer reporter, not from really understanding it, but just seeing how life worked and approach the economic side of it. And that's what Nolan Kant is about. And by the way, you say that people at Fox would love to get Emmys. They don't give Emmys to people at Fox. Emmys are garbage. They give them to socialist reporters who bash business. That's how I won those 19 Emmys. Then I wised up. Then I stopped winning any Emmy award. The No They Can't on the cover of my book is a play off of the last election campaign where there was all that excitement about the magic politician who said, yes, we can. And the intensity of that was extraordinary. And frankly, it's all great if we mean three people, but we, in their minds, in many people's minds, has come to mean the state. And this is really a bad idea. But as I've come to learn, it's intuitive. That maybe you understand life doesn't work that way, but to most people, I mean, there's all this polling information. People don't trust government. Congress has a 12% approval rating. That may be true, but the next time the crisis happens, people's instinctive reaction is that government's got to do something. I mean, think about after September 11th. We have to take over airport security. Tom Daschle said you can't professionalize if you don't federalize. It was instinctive. People were scared. The screeners had let these people go through. In fact, they had obeyed all the FAA rules, the small knives they brought on and the box cutters were legal. The unlocked cockpit doors, that was all legal. But nevertheless, they were minimum wage workers often and private profit-seeking contractors. People viewed that as a risk. And so now we get the TSA. And how's that working out for us? So you know your experience with it. I didn't realize the extent of it. It goes well beyond that. How much more do they spend than the private screeners? Not twice as much. 10 times as much they not spend. And in the law, they put in a part that said, if your city wants to opt out and go back to the system that Israel uses and Europe uses and most of the world uses, which is private contractors competing under government supervision, which of course is better because they have to compete, and you can fire them if they're bad. You can't fire the government. It creates some flexibility. If you want to do that, just ask the TSA and you can. And a couple of places have, Kansas City, the largest is San Francisco. So we go to San Francisco to shoot and we interview people and they say things like, gee, these screeners are nicer. And the line moves more quickly. And TSA undercover studies have found that they are much more likely to catch contraband in San Francisco than the government screeners are. And why is that? Do we look into it? Well, it's a private contractor who knows he has to work hard to keep the job. And he does all kinds of innovative experiments. They run contests where the best screener can win $2,000. Who can find the contraband fastest? Who can pack the bag most quickly? They then, to keep the airports happy so they get hired next year, they shift screeners around so the line keeps moving. So all these other airports want to get these private screeners, which is legal under the law, and they apply for permission to the TSA. The TSA ignores them for a year, doesn't even respond. And finally, a few months ago, they say, we don't think this would be advantageous to the federal government. That's the new standard, not how can we move people along, how can we keep people safe, what's advantageous to us. The bureaucracy has built an empire, and its goal is to keep itself going. This is what happened. This is not intuitive when people shout, yes, we can. Now, I've learned this the hard way. I was a consumer reporter on the left, cheering on government regulation. I became a libertarian when I finally saw it did not work. You were smarter about this than I, but it's not intuitive. We really have to work hard to explain this to people. We're not wired to understand that a free society can solve complex economic problems. We grew up in a family. We're programmed to believe that mommy and daddy know best and should plan for us. Our ancestors grew up in tribes where if you didn't obey the tribal leader and harvest the fruit at the right time, you died and you didn't give birth to us. We're programmed to follow the leader. The mechanism where Adam Smith showed us how the invisible hand can do this better just doesn't, maybe it makes sense to you, but it doesn't make sense to most Americans. I do these pieces which try to explain it to people, and Andrea Rich, who's sitting over here, runs a charity that gives them to high school students so we can at least introduce these ideas. And I hope you will support her or give her your card. But it's an uphill climb. And I see this again and again. I mean, one example of the success of private markets is in South America. I mean, the basket case that is central in South America. One country is doing quite well, that's Chile. And the biggest reason is because this guy named Jose Piñera, the finance minister, created private social security accounts. So instead of trusting the government to give you money, everybody has a little savings book, and they can watch the money appreciate, and it makes them think about their own money and investment. And through this simple innovation, Chile has prospered. And I give President Bush credit. He wasn't the best speaker, but he went to most every state trying to sell that in America and got nowhere because people here are horrified by the idea. So I go to Chile and expect to find people who will say, hey, this is great. But everybody I interview, nobody says that. Everybody says, oh, you know, the bank that administers this, the fee is too high, and government ought to step in and reduce income inequality. Nobody understood the mechanism that had made their lives better. I mean, this is also true in Hong Kong, Milton Friedman's famous example of the most popular high school video that Andrea gives out is one that says, is America number one? I ask students, why is America prosperous? And they think for a while, and they say, well, it's because we're a democracy. And I say, well, India's a democracy, and India's poor. Well, India's overpopulated. Actually, the population density of India is the same as that of New Jersey, which is doing okay. They say, well, India has, America has natural resources, but so does India. And we can say, well, what about Hong Kong? It doesn't have democracy, it doesn't have natural resources, yet it got rich. They went from third world to first world in just 50 years. They're as rich as we are. Why is that? They don't know, but of course it's because of economic liberty. And now we have these Heritage and Freedom House polls that compare countries by economic freedom, and the places that are free are the best places to live. But this is not intuitive. When I went to Hong Kong, I tried to open a business in New York. It took me months. In Hong Kong, I could open one in one day. And that's why they're prosperous. But when I asked people, they didn't know. They made the same comments the people in Chile made. Oh, yeah, the government should step in and fix this problem and fix that problem. And Chile reminds me, I know all of you are reading the New York Times less or have canceled your subscriptions, and I applaud you for that. But I read it because I really feel I have to know what my neighbors and my former ABC colleagues are worshiping. And did you see the Sunday magazine this week? This was the cover here. And a big story was this one. They made her an icon, which is impossible to live up to. So this is a story about a movement in Chile where they have some private schooling. They're doing quite well, but there is inequality. And because there is inequality, people are very upset. And so they're having occasional riots about why isn't college free. And the president of Chile, Sebastian Piñera, the younger brother of Jose now, had a good answer, I thought. He said he defended Chile's educational system by calling education a consumer good. And he went on to say that we would all like education, healthcare, and many other things to be free. But when all is said is done, oh, when all is said and done, nothing in life is free. Someone has to pay. Seems reasonable. Education isn't free. This was a hugely popular president. Remember, the miners were rescued. His popularity ratings were through the roof. And then these protests started. Now, part of the problem is that the people on our side look like, well, look around you. And the people on the other side look like her. She's the one being profiled in the New York Times. A 23-year-old communist with a nose ring. And she is popular now. Jose Sebastian Piñera is not. She's winning in this debate. She answered him saying someone has to pay by saying, of course someone has to pay. But why not the state through taxes on large corporations and the nationalization of resources? That just feels good to people. Sounds good. She went on to say, entrepreneurs had speculated and grown wealthy off the dreams and expectations of thousands of young people in Chilean families. Piñera's popularity ratings, which were way up, are now at 22%, the lowest of any Chilean president in history. The student movement popularity is 72%. Now, part of it is because she's young and good-looking, but most of it is because these ideas just make sense to people. They are intuitive. The idea that our brains are going to do economic reasoning just fights the way we were wired. We're not wired to reason out how impersonal market forces solve problems. And nobody goes to the streets to celebrate these marginal improvements that constantly happen. But it's economic freedom that works. Now, here too at the Manhattan Institute, you fight this. I want to branch off to one of my other areas where you have really led. Peter Huber talked about this. He says, in law school, we're taught that you can manage life through paper and procedure. And that makes sense to people. And hence, the tort bar has made themselves so rich. Because they set up the assumption that they will compensate the victims who are injured by you greedy corporate sellers of risky products, and they will deter you from doing it again. And this just makes sense to people. Big companies selling drugs that hurt somebody, somebody has to pay. The drug company should have put up more warning. It's, as you've heard here, it's such a horrible system. They say, who but we will compensate the victims? Well, there are lots of ways to compensate the victims. You can do it through government. You can do it through private charity. But this system is an awful way to do it because most of the money goes to the middlemen. I mean, you say, what do you mean most of the money? The tort bar only takes 30 to 40%. But you add in the defense costs and the court costs, 70% of the money almost goes to the middlemen. And it takes people 10 years to get paid. And then the wrong people get paid. A Harvard study in New York found in medical malpractice cases, most people who got paid were not victims of malpractice. And most who were victims didn't get anything. And yet this is the tort system that dominates in America and allows these guys to buy private jets and to kill product innovation. They even interfere with the information flow that helps free people protect themselves. When you fire someone now in your business, do you ever, and somebody calls up and says, you fired this guy, why? And let's say you fired him because he's lazy and reckless. You don't tell that company B that he's lazy and reckless because your human resources department will say, are you crazy? You'll get a labor lawsuit. And you'll spend $100,000 just defending what was your good decision. So you just say, we agreed to part company. So American doesn't even tell Delta when they fired a pilot because he was a drunk. It makes us less safe. And, well, again, it's so intuitive to say we should have more labels on everything to remind people that this could be risky. You know, what's the result? Ever look at a birth control pill label? I happen to have one here. Pretty well. I have yet to give birth. So how does this make us safer? This is what lawyers bring us. It's tiny fine print. And it's true, if you read this, you wouldn't want the pill anymore. They don't make us safer. They make us poorer. They deprive us of innovation. Could you refold this for me? But they win. Because intuition is on their side. Yes, we can make you safe. Capitalism performs miracles all the time, leaving people alone. I mean, we've lifted more people out of the mud and misery of poverty through markets in the third world than ever before. Nobody in America notices. People here say, why isn't education free? The Occupy Wall Street protests down there, they want more. We take it for granted that we, at supermarkets, have 30,000 products, and they rarely poison anybody, and all the products are cheap. And we take it for granted that I can go to a foreign country, stick a piece of plastic in the wall, and cash will come out. And I can give that same piece of plastic to a total stranger, and he'll rent me a car for a week. And when I get home, Visa or MasterCard will have the accounting correct the penny. The government, by contrast, can't even count the votes accurately. And yet, Obama was elected partly on the message, we're going to fix health care. And Obamacare, by the time it passed, may not have been popular, but most people in the country wanted the government to do something about health care. And health care really isn't a free market even before Obamacare. It's already been messed up by all the government steps that encourage people to buy insurance that somebody else pays. But the results are already out there, and they're already awful. A couple of years ago, the Detroit Medical Center announced proudly that it was using barcodes to use computers to electronically keep track of all its patients and all their medical records and the drugs they took. And yay, isn't this great? But think about it. Supermarkets did that 40 years ago. I mean, Coke and Pepsi is obviously less important than our medical records. But it took 40 years of insanity before we brought this to the system where insurance companies and government is pulling the strings. Friedrich Hayek said, "The curious task of economics is to teach man how little he understands about what he thinks he can design." That's what I hope to do with Nobody Can. It's a big battle. I thank you for fighting it. Clearly, leaving people free is what makes us prosperous. And economists tend to focus on the prosperous part of that statement. That's not the most important one. The free part is. It sounds vague, but it's just as important because individuals and their freedom matter. It's a moral objection to big government to say it leaves us less free, because if control over our own lives is diminished, if we can't tell the mob or even our neighbors to leave us alone, we are not just free. We are not just less free. We are less. Big government makes us all smaller. I thank you for fighting against that.
So John will answer questions. We have the mic. It's a big room. So all I have to do, I'll let John field the question. So please wait for the microphone to get to you and tell us who you are so that we can all hear. All right, thanks.
And I would just let you ladies do the mic so then we go quickly back and forth. And right. You pick whoever you.
Thank you very much for not only this talk, but for all your entertaining and educational talks on TV. As a lawyer who has represented corporations in actions of the type you talked about, in firing people and other things, I can say that unfortunately you're being a piker in saying that it would only cost $100,000 of legal fees. What I want to do is ask you this question. I tell you I'm a conservative, not a libertarian. And I've always wondered what you would say in answer to the question, because you constantly on television and elsewhere speak against government intervention in various things. Where does libertarianism end and anarchy begin? How do we avoid, which I assume you would want to avoid, anarchy, and yet have freedom for people?
Well, I think the founders had it pretty good. This is the Constitution. It's much thinner than what we have now. But basically, you should be allowed to, libertarians say people should be allowed to do anything that's peaceful, which means there's a role for government to make sure I don't kill you or hurt you or take your stuff. And this libertarian would go further. Others would say the tort system would handle pollution, but I'm happy to have government to have pollution control rules. And like Hayek, I'm happy to have government have a limited social safety net. But that's about it, and that's all we need. And America grew fastest during our first 150 years when government was less than 5% of the economy. Now it's 40% and growing. Under 5% would be good.
All right. I saw your program last night.
You have to introduce yourself,
Larry. Okay. My name is Bob Weisberg. I'm a sometime professor of political science. Enjoy your program.
Now, last night when I was watching the program, you had something on Head Start, and you showed that Head Start was a failure. Now, that's been known almost from the day Head Start was created.
But I didn't know.
I knew. You should have called me up. Okay. By law, Head Start has to be evaluated every year, and those evaluations are then stockpiled in some government basement. Now, my question is this. Are you really think that Head Start is about helping young children become smarter, or is it really a make-work job program? And many of what you're talking about, airport security, Head Start, all these terrible programs are not really terrible when it comes to making government jobs. That's their real purpose. So how would you respond to the fact that governments have called their programs all sorts of things, but many of them are nothing more than job creation things, and by those measures, they're very good.
They are, and that's what they become. But I'm more cynical than you. I really think the people behind these programs think they're going to work. And Head Start was a good example. How could it not work? Again, intuitively, it just has to work. You have our kids. We read to them. Most have two parents. They're going to have a Head Start, obviously. Why not in a rich country spend some government money? They spent about $180 billion so far to give the truly needy a little Head Start, pre-kindergarten. Some caring teachers, and when they start school, they won't be as far behind. But then finally, as you say, the government evaluates the program. They compare the kids later. And it wasn't just that by high school there was no difference. There was no difference. They couldn't tell who had Head Start and who didn't.
Well, John Stossel makes you think, if nothing else, and we hope you go listen to the rest of his presentations. We got through actually just about half of it, and that's a good start. But you can get it on booktv.org, or John Stossel would be very pleased if you go out and buy his book. And it's called No, They Can't, Why Government Fails But Individuals Succeed. Well, that's it for tonight, folks. We're going to catch you the next time. And we'll have Vera Lynn sing her wonderful song, We'll Meet Again.
We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far away. So will you please say hello to the folks that I know, tell them I won't be long. They'll be happy to know that as you saw me go, I was singing this song. We'll meet again. Don't know when, don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day.